Wallawani Nindawan, you're listening to Earth Matters, produced in the studios of 3CR down on Kulin Lands and broadcast nationally across the Community Radio Network. My name's Kieran Stewart Asherton, and I'm your host for today. I've got a special episode for you all today. I'm going to be talking a bit about what I call Invasion Day. You might know it as Australia Day, the 26th of January. It's the beginning of a violent occupation that has never ended. It marks the arrival of a foreign power asserting ownership over land that was already inhabited, already governed, already named, and already cared for. From the moment the British flag was planted, this continent was subjected to dispossession, massacres, forced removals, and the systematic destruction of First Nations societies. Frontier violence wasn't accidental or isolated, it was policy. It was how the colony expanded. It was how land was cleared for farms, mines, and towns. And crucially, this violence did not end in the 19th century. It evolved. It bureaucratized. It became legal, administrative, and economic. Whether it's the reserve systems, the missions, the stolen generations, the denial of wages, the theft of children, language, culture, land, and resources, it all flows from the same starting point, invasion. This matters, especially on a program like Earth Matters, because invasion didn't just target people, it targeted country itself. Colonization imposed an entirely different relationship to land, one that's based on extraction, ownership, and profit. Forests become timber, rivers became irrigation channels, mountains became ore bodies, living systems became resources. The myth of settlement is essential to maintaining this system. If Australia was peacefully settled, then the environmental destruction that followed can be framed as unfortunate side effects of progress. If it was an invasion, though, then what followed is what invasions always produce: exploitation, exhaustion, and collapse. Now, language matters here. When we say settlement, we erase violence. When we say discovery, we erase presence. When we say Australia Day, we erase the grief, the trauma, the pain and the hurt that has been occurring here for over two centuries now. Erasure is not harmless either. It is an active process that allows the colonial state to continue claiming legitimacy over land it never lawfully acquired. That's why there is such resistance every year to calling this day what it is. Because once invasion is acknowledged, everything else becomes unstable. Property rights, resource extraction, national identity, environmental governance, it all unravels. If this country was founded on invasion, then the land was stolen. If the land was stolen, then the state's authority over it is illegitimate. And if that authority is illegitimate, then so too are the industries destroying it. This is why Invasion Day is not just about history, it's about the present. It's about mining approvals, logging licenses, fossil fuel projects, conservation policies. All of it rests on the same original lie. So when people ask, why can't we just move on? The answer is simple. You can't move on from something that never stopped. First Nations people are still fighting for land, still fighting for water, still fighting for the right to care for country without state interference, still fighting the impacts of policies that prioritise profit over life. January 26 celebrates none of this reality. It demands silence, gratitude and compliance. It demands that invasion be remembered as nation building and resistance be remembered as inconvenience. Refusing that narrative is not divisive, it is honest. Calling it Invasion Day is not about rewriting history. It's about telling the truth that has always been there, deliberately buried beneath flags, fireworks, and hollow patriotism. And until that truth is confronted, there can be no meaningful discussion about environmental justice, climate action, or a livable future on this continent, because you cannot heal the land while denying how it was wounded. And once we are honest about invasion, we can be honest about its consequences. Because colonization was not only a human catastrophe, it was and remains an environmental one. The invasion of this continent imposed a foreign system of land use onto one of the oldest continuously managed ecosystems on Earth. For tens of thousands of years, country was cared for throughout relational knowledge, whether it be fire, water, seasons, kinship, obligation. Land was not owned, it was lived with. But colonization shattered that relationship. Almost immediately, ecosystems were re-engineered to serve imperial needs. Forests were cleared for timber and pasture. Rivers were dammed, diverted, and poisoned. Wetlands were drained. Native grasses were replaced with European monocultures that exhausted soil and demanded constant intervention. This wasn't ignorance, it was arrogance. The colonial project assumed superiority, not just over indigenous people, but over the land itself. Country was treated as inert, as empty, as something to be conquered and reshaped rather than listened to. And the consequences were swift. Introduced species devastated native ecologies, hard-hooved animals compacted fragile soils, rabbits stripped landscapes bare, foxes and cats drove countless species toward extinction, fire regimes were disrupted, turning low-intensity cultural burning to the high-intensity infernos we now call natural disasters. But disasters are not natural when they are created. The drying of rivers, the collapse of fish stocks, the salinization of farmland, the extinction crisis. These are not unfortunate side effects of development. They are the predictable outcomes of imposing a colonial economic system onto country that was never meant to sustain it. And this is where environmental conversations often fail. We talk about climate change as though it appeared suddenly, as though the problem began with carbon emissions in the 20th century. But the ecological crisis on this continent began in 1788. Climate change is an intensification of a much older violence. The colonial state's entire model depends on extraction. Take more, grow faster, export everything. Externalize the damage, and when the land begins to fail, blame drought, blame weather, blame nature. But country has been responding, logically and consistently, to two centuries of abuse. The refusal to center invasion in environmental discussions allows this cycle to continue. It allows governments to frame destruction as mismanagement rather than structural violence. It allows corporations to promise sustainability while operating on stolen land under illegitimate authority. And it allows environmental movements, particularly large, well-funded NGOs, to treat colonization as a side issue rather than the foundation of the crisis they claim to oppose. You cannot separate ecological collapse from the system that caused it. You cannot separate it from the fences, the mines, the dams, the carbon markets. These are not neutral tools, they are colonial technologies. This is why First Nations people have always been at the forefront of environmental resistance. Not because of romanticism, not because of symbolism, but because invasion directly disrupted the systems that sustain life here. Country remembers, country holds memory, and country responds. The fires we are seeing, the floods, the species lost, the poisoned waterways, these are not isolated events, but they are symptoms of an unresolved invasion playing out across land and water. So when we talk about protecting the environment without naming colonization, we are not being pragmatic, we are being dishonest. Because until the relationship between people and country is fundamentally transformed, away from ownership and towards responsibility, the destruction will continue, regardless of how many policies, pledges, or offsets are announced. Colonization is not in the past, it is etched into the landscape all around us, and any environmental politics that refuses to confront that truth is not a solution, it is part of the problem. And this is where the conversation has to sharpen, because what is now called the climate crisis is not a separate issue laid on top of colonization, it is colonization reaching its logical conclusion. The same system that invaded this continent is the system overheating the planet. The same worldview that justified land theft now justifies ecological collapse. Endless growth, infinite extraction, profit over life. Climate change did not emerge in a vacuum. It emerged from a global colonial economy built on stolen land, stolen labour, and stolen futures. Fossil fuels were not just an energy source, they were an accelerant for empire. Coal-powered industry, oil-powered wars, gas-powered expansions, entire economies were reorganised around extraction, while the damage was pushed onto Indigenous lands, the global south, and future generations. Australia is not an exception to this system, it is a textbook example. Coal mines carved into country, gas projects forced through without consent, sacred sites destroyed in the name of shareholder value, all of it is framed as national interest, as though the nation itself were not a colonial construction imposed through violence. The climate crisis is often discussed as a technical problem. Emissions targets, net zero pathways, market mechanisms. But these frameworks deliberately avoid the deeper question, who has the right to decide what happens to the land? Because once you ask that question, the entire system begins to unravel. Carbon offsets allow pollution to continue just somewhere else, usually on Indigenous land. Green growth promises new extraction under a different banner. Renewable energy projects replicate the same colonial dynamics if they are imposed without consent and control. The colour of the technology does not change the nature of the system. This is why climate solutions coming from governments and corporations consistently fail or fall short at the very least. They are designed to preserve the colonial economy, not to dismantle it. They aim to manage collapse, not to prevent it. And this is where the language of emergency becomes dangerous. When climate change is framed as a sudden crisis, it invites authoritarian responses, fast-tracked approvals, suspended protections, silenced dissent. It creates urgency without accountability and action without justice. For First Nations people, this pattern is familiar. Emergency has always been used to justify intervention, dispossession, and control. And yet, Indigenous knowledge, the very knowledge that sustained these lands through climate extremes for tens of thousands of years, is treated as something optional, consulted when convenient, ignored when it challenges power. This is the contradiction at the heart of the mainstream climate politics. It demands Indigenous wisdom while denying Indigenous sovereignty, but you cannot have one without the other. Climate justice is not achievable through inclusion alone. It requires a fundamental shift in who holds authority over land, water, and decision-making. It requires decolonization, not as metaphor, not as branding, but as actual material change. Because a system that requires permanent extraction will always destroy the conditions that make life possible. So when we say the climate crisis is a colonial crisis, we are not being rhetorical. We are naming the cause and the effect. Colonialism created the crisis, colonialism is maintaining it, and colonialism will not solve it. Only a complete transformation in how we relate to country, a transformation that is grounded in responsibility rather than domination, only that transformation offers any real chance of survival. Anything less is delay, and delay in this context is a death sentence. And this is where the narrative has to change. Because despite everything, despite invasion, dispossession, ecological destruction, the solutions to this crisis are not hypothetical. They are not new technologies waiting to be invented. They already exist, embedded in country, held by the people who have cared for it since time immemorial. First Nations land management is not cultural heritage, it is climate action. For tens of thousands of years, Indigenous people across this continent actively shaped ecosystems in ways that enhance biodiversity, reduce catastrophic fire, maintain water systems, and ensured food security. This was not passive stewardship, it was sophisticated environmental governance. Culture burning is one example. Low intensity, seasonal fire reduced fuel loads, protected canopy species, and created mosaics of habitat that supported diverse life. These practices didn't just prevent megafires, they made country resilient. Water management is another. Songlines mapped hydrology. Wetlands were protected and replenished. Fish traps were engineered to harvest without collapse. Floodplains were understood as living systems. Food systems too were local, diverse and adaptive. Native grains, tubers, fish and game were harvested in accordance with seasonal law, ensuring regeneration rather than depletion. None of this was accidental. It was knowledge built over countless generations, refined through observation, responsibility, and relationship. Colonization attempted to erase this knowledge, dismissing it as primitive, inefficient, or irrelevant. Fire was banned. Movement across country was restricted. Indigenous people were removed from the very landscapes they were responsible for maintaining. The result was ecological instability. When Indigenous fire regimes were suppressed, fuel loads accumulated. When waterways were channeled and dammed, floods became disasters. When monocultures replaced biodiverse systems, landscapes became fragile. And now, in the face of escalating climate impacts, the colonial state turns back to First Nations knowledge, but on its own terms. We see cultural burning rebranded as a tool, stripped of its governance structures. We see Indigenous rangers employed to implement policies they do not actually control. We see knowledge extracted while sovereignty is denied. This is not respect, it is appropriation. Because First Nations land management cannot be separated from authority, these practices work precisely because they are embedded within systems of law, kinship, and accountability to country. You cannot cherry-pick techniques while maintaining colonial control. Real climate action requires returning decision-making power to the people whose knowledge is grounded in place. It requires land back, not as symbolism, but as a material condition for ecological repair. This doesn't mean freezing landscapes in the past. Indigenous land management has always been adaptive. It responds to changing conditions, including climate shifts, but it does so within limits, guided by responsibility rather than profit. Contrast that with the colonial model, which demands constant growth, even as ecosystems collapse. So when governments claim to be serious about climate action while continuing to marginalise Indigenous authority, they are lying. They are lying to themselves and they are lying to the public. The path forward is not more control, more policing, or more extraction with greener language. It is trust. It is restitution. It is relinquishing power. Because the land is already telling us what works. The question is not whether First Nations land management is viable. The question is whether the colonial state is willing to step aside. And so far, history suggests it is not. Which brings us to the next problem. The way environmental politics in this country often protects land from people rather than protecting people's relationship to land. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Earth Matters, and today we're talking about Invasion Day and the relationship colonialism has to the current climate catastrophes that we're seeing, not just right across this continent, but right across the entire globe. And, you know, we're talking about January 26th and why this matters so much to the colonial state. Because Australia Day is not just a celebration, it is a political ritual. It exists to reaffirm the legitimacy of the nation, and in doing so, to protect the systems that continue to destroy land and life. Nationalism is not harmless pride. It is a story that demands loyalty, silence, and selective memory. On January 26th, we are told to celebrate progress, to be grateful for development, to look at the skyline, the highways, the exports, and to call it success. But that story requires forgetting what was destroyed to build it. It requires forgetting the forests that were cleared, the rivers that were poisoned, the species that we've lost, and the cultures that have been attacked. Australia Day nationalism insists that these are acceptable losses and acceptable costs, the price of becoming a modern nation. Environmental destruction is reframed as unfortunate but necessary, inevitable, even natural. And this framing is powerful because it shuts down dissent. To question the nation on its birthday is framed as ungrateful. To name invasion is framed as divisive. To challenge extraction is framed as anti-Australian. This is not accidental. National myths are designed to protect economic interests. They create emotional attachment to a system that materially harms people and country. They turn critique into betrayal and resistance into inconvenience. And this has direct consequences for environmental politics. When land is framed as national property rather than Indigenous country, its destruction can be justified in the name of national interest. Mines become jobs, gas becomes energy security, logging becomes regional development. The land is not allowed to exist for its own sake, it must serve the nation. Australia Day reinforces this logic by celebrating conquest as origin. It normalises the idea that land exists to be claimed, to be used and to be exhausted, that domination is not only acceptable, but foundational. This is why environmental destruction is so often met with denial, delay, or distraction. Acknowledging ecological collapse would require acknowledging the lie at the heart of the national story. Because if this nation was built on invasion, and if that invasion set in motion the destruction we are now facing, then Australia Day is not a celebration. It is a commemoration of ecological and social harm. And that is politically intolerable for those in power. So instead, we get symbolism without substance, flags without responsibility, fireworks while the land continues to burn, calls for unity while First Nations people are told to move on from the past. This nationalism doesn't just erase history, it actively undermines environmental action. It frames care for country as radical, when in fact it is the most ancient and practical form of survival. It demands faith in a system that has proven itself incapable of protecting life. And it disciplines environmental movements too. NGOs are pressured to soften their language, to avoid controversial days like Jan 26, to focus on policy tweaks rather than structural change, to protect donor comfort rather than to tell the truth. But ecological collapse does not negotiate with national myths. The land does not care about your flags. The climate does not recognize your borders. Country does not consent to its own destruction. So, on Invasion Day, refusing nationalism is not negativity, it is clarity. It is the refusal to participate in a story that justifies harm in the name of belonging. Because until the myth of the nation is confronted, the destruction it authorizes will continue, wrapped in patriotism and defended as progress. And once nationalism is stripped away, we are left with the central question that environmental politics in this country keeps trying to avoid. Who controls the land? Because without answering that honestly, there can be no environmental justice, only management of collapse. Land back is often treated as a slogan, something symbolic, something aspirational, something that can be acknowledged rhetorically and ignored materially. But land back is not a metaphor. It means returning land to Indigenous ownership, governance, and authority. It means ending the assumption that the colonial state has the right to decide what happens on country. And it means recognising that ecological repair is impossible while land remains under the control of the very system that destroyed it. This is where mainstream environmentalism falters. Conservation, as practiced under colonial frameworks, often removes Indigenous people from land in the name of protection. National parks are created, access is restricted, traditional practices are regulated or criminalised. Meanwhile, extractive industries continue elsewhere with state approval. This is not justice, it is enclosure. It treats land as something to be locked away rather than something to be lived with, and it reproduces the same colonial logic, that Indigenous people are a threat to nature rather than its caretakers. Land back challenges this entirely though. It asserts that the people who have sustained ecosystems for millennia are best placed to repair them. It recognises that land is not just a site of biodiversity, but of law, culture, and responsibility. And it exposes the fundamental contradiction. You cannot claim to care about the environment while refusing to relinquish control over stolen land. Environmental justice requires more than reducing emissions or protecting habitats. It requires dismantling the structures that prioritize profit over life. It requires restitution, not consultation. Because consultation without power is meaningless. And this is why land back is framed as radical or unrealistic, because it threatens the foundations of property, capital, and state authority. But ecological collapse is already radical. Mass extinction is already unrealistic. A livable future cannot be built on stolen ground. Without this shift, environmental politics will continue to chase symptoms while protecting causes. New policies will be announced, new targets will be missed, new disasters will be mourned, and land will continue to suffer under the same regime of control. So on Invasion Day, land back is not an abstract demand. It is the minimum condition for survival, because justice for land cannot exist while the land remains stolen. And this is why many people and many movements become uncomfortable, because solidarity, as it is often practiced, is symbolic. It is statements, it is social media posts, it is showing up once a year, feeling moved and then returning to business as usual. But symbolic solidarity does not shift power, and power is the issue. On Invasion Day, it is easy to say the right words. It is easy to acknowledge that the date is painful, that the history is violent, that First Nations people are still here. None of that costs very much. What costs something is acting in ways that materially challenge the colonial system. Real solidarity requires giving something up, whether that be comfort, certainty, access, or control. It requires settlers and institutions to stop centering themselves, their timelines, their strategies, their reputations, and to start following Indigenous leadership, even when it is inconvenient or disruptive. Because solidarity is not an agreement, it is an alignment. And alignment means accepting that decolonization will not be neat, polite, or comfortable. It will unsettle identities. It will disrupt industries. It will challenge ideas of ownership and entitlement that many people have been taught to take for granted. This is why solidarity so often collapses into symbolism, because symbolism allows people to feel aligned without being changed. But Invasion Day does not ask for feelings, it asks for responsibility. Responsibility to support land back in material ways, to oppose extractive projects even when they promise jobs or economic growth, to challenge institutions, including environmental organizations, when they prioritize funding, access, or political proximity over justice. Solidarity also means refusing the temptation to moderate Indigenous demands so they are more palatable to the mainstream. There is a long history of settlers telling First Nations people to slow down, to compromise, to be strategic, usually for the comfort of the colonial system. But this is not solidarity, it is control. True solidarity accepts that Indigenous sovereignty does not need approval. It recognises that First Nations people do not need to justify their resistance in terms that are acceptable to the colonial state. And it understands that neutrality is not an option. In moments of invasion, silence is alignment with power. In moments of ecological collapse, delay is complicity. So on this day and every day, solidarity means choosing sides. Not in a rhetorical, symbolical sense, but in a material sense. Because the future will not be shaped by who said the right thing on January 26th. It will be shaped by who is willing to act when it mattered, and who was willing to step aside when it was not their place to lead. Solidarity is not a performance, it is a commitment. And commitments, by definition, change how we live, organize, and fight for the future. The future is either decolonial or it is unlivable. And this is where all of this leads. Not to a slogan, not to hope as a feeling, but to choice. Because the trajectory we are on is not ambiguous, the land is heating, waters are rising, species are disappearing, and the system managing this crisis is the same system that created it. There is no reform path that leaves colonial power intact and somehow produces a livable future. That option does not exist. Every attempt to preserve the colonial relationship to land, through markets, offsets, green extraction or symbolic recognition, delays the inevitable while deepening the damage. It asks country to endure just a little more violence in the name of stability. But country is already at its limits. A decolonial future is not a utopia. It does not promise comfort or ease. What it promises is coherence, a way of living that does not require destruction to function. It means land governed by those with responsibility to it. It means economies organized around care, not accumulation. It means limits that are respected, not treated as obstacles to growth. And it means telling the truth, fully and without apology, about where we are and how we got here. Decolonization is often framed as something threatening, something extreme, something that would tear society apart. But what we are living through now is already tearing society apart. Floods do not negotiate, fires do not compromise, collapse does not wait for consensus. The question is not whether change is coming. The question is whether it will come through conscious transformation or whether it will come through catastrophe. First Nations people have never stopped asserting sovereignty. They have never stopped resisting. They have never stopped caring for country, even when forcibly removed from it. The rest of society is now being forced to catch up. On Invasion Day, the choice becomes harder to avoid. We can cling to myths, rituals, and symbols that no longer hold, or we can face the reality that survival requires a different relationship to land, to power, and to each other. A future worth living in will not be built on denial, it will not be built on stolen land, and it will not be built by the same system that brought us here. It will be decolonial, or it will not be at all. Quick shout out to Community Broadcasting Foundation.